Chapter 6. Deciding to be different. Letting your bank account earn maximum interest. Pause and consider all that has been covered in the preceding chapters. The nature of confidence and the inescapable fact that the ultimate source of confidence is the way you think about yourself, your life, and the things that happen to you in your life. The need to be selective in your thinking and the process for doing so. Using your human free will to mentally filter in and emphasize the thoughts and memories that build energy, optimism, and enthusiasm, while deliberately releasing or restructuring the thoughts and memories that do anything else. These specific tools and techniques for building up your mental bank account, managing your memories, repeating the constructive stories, and envisioning your desired future. The mental tools and techniques to prevent life's inevitable setbacks, human imperfections, and our own negative thoughts from drawing our mental bank account down, rationalizing the setbacks as temporary, limited, and non-representative, and using each negative thought as a trigger to stop, cope, and take control. All this is designed to help you win the first victory of decisiveness and trust at the moment of truth when it's time to perform. By following these guidelines, you will be less likely to fall back into analysis, judgment, and worry during any performance because you have, one, built up that large bank account of reasons to believe in yourself, two, reduced the self-criticism and self-distraction to a minimum, and three, kept your mind focused on what you want to accomplish and how you want to be, rather than on what you fear or wish to avoid. These practices are effective and are well supported by science. Despite their effectiveness, however, they have yet to become mainstream teachings in schools and have yet to be generally accepted throughout modern society. As mentioned in the introduction, modern society is very ambivalent when it comes to confidence. It's personally important to have some, but socially deadly to have too much. And just how much is just right is never made clear. In this chapter, I challenge you to look carefully at some of the assumptions and ideas that are prevalent in our culture regarding the development and expression of confidence. It's likely that you were exposed to some ideas and understandings during your upbringing and early training that encouraged you to conform and fit in rather than stand out and express yourself fully. The process of socialization, defined by the Oxford Dictionary of English as the process of learning to behave in a way that is acceptable to society, is a double-edged sword. It provides safety and security, but it doesn't always encourage the search for your personal excellence. If you desire to find out how great you can be at your chosen sport, art, or profession and win a consistent first victory, you are going to have to confront this negative aspect of socialization and decide to think differently. This chapter shows you how. A Case Study in Thinking Differently, Deion Sanders. To take our understanding and practice of the first victory further, let's conduct a case study and examine the thinking process of a very confident and high-performing individual. I've always been a fan of case study research, going directly to the people who are exhibiting an interesting or valuable trait, studying them carefully, and then sharing the knowledge collected. One of my top 10 recommended sports psychology books is The Pursuit of Sporting Excellence, a study of sports highest achievers, written by British track athlete David Hemery, gold medalist 1968 Olympics, 400-meter hurdles. Why do I recommend it? Because it's about real people who distinguish themselves in the real world of human performance. Hemery interviewed 50 champions and top performers across a wide range of sports to determine if there were common factors among sports' highest achievers, which could be applied to anyone who aspired to fulfill their talent. Hemery's case studies provide valuable insights into what really works in the real world, and not surprisingly, 87% of the athletes interviewed said they had a very high degree of self-confidence. Some of the most influential business books have used a similar case study approach. In 1982, management consultants Tom Peters and Bob Waterman published In Search of Excellence, Lessons from America's Best-Run Companies, where they identified the characteristics and practices that separated a few highly successful companies from the majority of American businesses. Over the next 15 years, the book sold 4.5 million copies and remains to this day one of the classic works in the field. In 2001, Jim Collins published Good to Great: Why Some Companies Make the Leap and Others Don't. This book also described the defining characteristics and practices of companies that separated them from the pack, and it too became a bestseller. What all three of these books had in common was their case study approach. Rather than proceed from an idea or a theory about success and seek out examples as proof, these authors went directly to these successful companies and individuals and learned what they did that separated them from the others. What made them different? In this spirit, let's examine how a very successful individual built and maintained an impressive mental bank account to separate himself from his competition, and pay attention to just how different his thinking is from the mainstream. This examination will lead us to important questions about some of the underlying assumptions and beliefs that influence our mental bank account. Have those beliefs kept us from winning our first victory by encouraging overanalysis and other forms of ineffective thinking? Or have they helped us move forward and separate ourselves from competitors and opponents? Can we embrace new and more constructive beliefs that will help us keep winning our first victory? Absolutely. Meet our case study subject, Deion Sanders. Anyone who's played in the Super Bowl will tell you it's an incredible, never-to-be-forgotten experience. Anyone who's played in a World Series game will say the same. But there's only one person on Earth who has played in both the Super Bowl and a World Series game. That person is Deion Sanders, the Hall of Fame football defensive back and former Major League Baseball outfielder. With two Super Bowl rings, 8 Pro Bowl appearances, and until 2014, an unbroken NFL record of 19 returns for touchdowns, Sanders made good on his stated intention. I never wanted to be mediocre at anything. I wanted to be the absolute best. I'll leave it to football pundits to decide whether Sanders was the absolute best. But no one will ever argue that Sanders was even close to being mediocre. That word, mediocre, comes from the Latin mediocris, which means middling, ordinary, unremarkable, terms that could never be applied to the man known as Prime Time and Neon Deion. Sanders began his professional football career in 1989, playing for the Atlanta Falcons while also playing baseball for the Atlanta Braves. He played the 1994 NFL season with the San Francisco 49ers and helped them become Super Bowl champion that year. It was during this season that he gave a remarkable, in my opinion, television interview on ESPN. In the course of a 5-minute interview with former NFL quarterback Joe Theismann, Sanders made 5 statements that serve as beautiful examples for anyone seeking to win their first victory. The interview begins after some sparkling highlight footage of Sanders intercepting passes and celebrating touchdowns, with him speaking plainly and simply, "I believe that I am better than you," not with any bravado or swagger, but with a calm matter-of-factness. 30 seconds later, Sanders can be heard saying, "I will outplay you on that specific play," again, as a plain-as-day statement. Barely 20 seconds later, Theismann, the interviewer, starts to set up his next question by beginning with, "When the ball is up in the air," but Sanders doesn't even let him finish. He interrupts Theismann and delivers one of the most insightful comments I have ever heard from any performer. Sanders says, referring to the ball in the air, "It's mine. It's for me. It's not for him. It's for me. It was meant to come to me when the ball is up in the air. I think that's the attitude a defensive back must have. Fourth, Sanders replies to a question about his foot technique at the line of scrimmage by saying, "I change it up all the time. I have them thinking about me. I change the whole philosophy in their mind. Now they have to worry about me and what I'm going to do." Last, Sanders responds to a question about his new team, the 49ers, by saying, "They have to believe in themselves, and that's what I do. I help the secondary believe in themselves." Each of these comments provides a window into Sanders' mental filter and how he wins his first victories. Examine each one carefully. 1. I believe that I am better than you. Whether this statement is factually true or not doesn't really matter. Was Sanders indeed better than the wide receivers that he was assigned to cover? Again, I'll leave that up to the pundits and statisticians. What does matter, however, is that Sanders genuinely believes he's better. When he takes the field to play, he believes that he is better than his opponent of the moment. And that conviction frees him to execute with the absolute bare minimum of self-consciousness and the momentary hesitation that such mental chatter might produce. Is he justified in having that belief? Again, that's beside the point. Just as we have seen with the shooter's mentality, there is a time and a place for using logic to justify your inner feelings and beliefs. But there's also a time to throw logic aside and believe that the odds are always in your favor. I urge every client and student of mine to embrace and practice this habit of belief. Believing you are better than any opponent you face is a prerequisite for bringing out your best performance, whether that opponent is another human being, as in any athletic contest, or whether that opponent is a report to be written, a concerto to be played, or a blocked artery to be surgically bypassed. Are you willing to choose to believe that you are better than the opponent in that moment, or will you choose to believe something else? First victory takeaway: approach every task with a conviction that you will absolutely succeed. 2. I will outplay you on that specific play. When you play cornerback in the NFL, the rules are stacked against you. Wide receivers with world-class speed are coming at you full tilt along a pre-planned route, while you have to backpedal and then make an informed guess as to where exactly they are going. While remarkably gifted with natural speed and having diligently trained to backpedal quickly, every cornerback, Sanders included, is going to lose that foot race a few times every game. He's going to get beat on some plays. Passes are going to be completed against him, and even the occasional touchdown will be scored by the man he was assigned to cover. But when this happens, Sanders practices Bruce Lee's rule of rationalizing the failure by treating it as temporary. It was just that one play, and limited, it was just in that one place. With that kind of selective memory, Sanders can forget if you happen to beat him on the last play and bring all his energy and talent to bear so he can beat you on this specific play right now. First victory takeaway: the only moment that matters is this one. Live it freely of any resistance from your past. 3. It's mine. It's for me. It's not for him. It's for me. It was meant to come to me when the ball is up in the air. I think that's the attitude a defensive back must have. At first glance, this comment is utterly ridiculous. The ball in the air was most certainly not meant to come to Deion Sanders. The opposing quarterback, receivers, and coaching staff all spent hours of their weekly preparation designing and practicing plays that would keep the ball away from Sanders. But in his highly selective and functionally delusional mind, Sanders considers that ball in the air to be his and his alone. I urge all my clients and students to think about that ball in the air as a situation with an as-of-yet undetermined outcome. When the football is up in the air, spiraling along, no one really knows for sure where it will land or what will ultimately happen to it. It might be caught. It might be dropped. It might be knocked out of the air. It might fall harmlessly to the turf with no one touching it. That uncertain situation can be viewed in a number of ways. It can be viewed somewhat neutrally, with the "we'll see what happens to it" attitude. It can also be viewed with a sense of dread and foreboding. Uh-oh, this could be bad for me/us. But the uncertain situation of a ball in the air, and indeed any uncertain situation, can also be viewed through a functionally optimistic and confident mental filter as "this was meant to turn out in my/our favor." Please pause for a moment and consider what uncertain situations you face every day in your work or your sport practice or your professional life. Do you share Deion Sanders' "it was meant to come to me" attitude about each of them? I counsel every athlete trying out for a team to think, "that roster spot was meant for me." I counsel every athlete on a team to think, "that spot on the starting lineup is mine." And I counsel every starter on any team to think, "that All-League or All-American award is mine." Deion Sanders says, "I think that's the attitude a defensive back must have." Dr. Zinser says, "I think that's the attitude every athlete, every professional, and every performer must have." First victory takeaway: every uncertain situation is meant to come out in your favor, so act with absolute certainty. 4. I change it up all the time. I have them thinking about me. I change the whole philosophy in their mind. Now they have to worry about me and what I am going to do. I'm not sure if Sanders actually changes any of his opponent's philosophy, but I agree completely with the principle he's working from. Rather than think, "okay, I've got to cover blank, insert Randy Moss, Jerry Rice, Andre Rison, or any other top-level wide receiver of Sanders' era, and make sure he doesn't burn us for big plays," Sanders' attitude come game time is that Randy Moss, or whoever, is going to have his hands full trying to beat me. He's going to have to up his game a ton if he's going to get anything on me. Rather than think that he has to elevate his game to match any opponent or succeed in any new situation, Sanders, and any mentally tough pro, takes the view that the new opponent or new situation has to come up to his present level of competence. The pressure is no longer on him. Now it's on the other guy. Mind you, Sanders will put in plenty of preparation and study to be ready to perform at a high level. But he will also, and this is the key, decide that his level of preparation is always enough, and that the pressure is now on the other guy. Who are your equivalents of the top-level wide receivers that Deion Sanders must cover? Who are your opponents and competitors, and how do you tend to think about them? Are they obstacles or forces that require you to dig down deep, to find some special reserve of strength or smarts that will allow success? Do you put pressure on yourself by thinking, "I have to really be great in order to be so-and-so or make that deadline"? Or do you allow yourself a little peace of mind by thinking, "that opponent has to beat me. All I have to do is play my game / do my work, and I'll be fine"? Is the pressure on you, or is it on the other guy to beat you? Is the pressure on you to make that deadline, or is the pressure on the deadline to try and crack your composure? For an alternate look at this attitude, there is a wonderful scene from the movie Men of Honor, the true story of Carl Brashear, the first African-American, and the first amputee to earn the U.S. Navy rank of Master Chief Petty Officer. Brashear suffered a severe leg injury midway through his 30-year Navy career during the recovery of a nuclear warhead from the ocean floor off the coast of Spain. Rather than leave the Navy with his dream of making Master Chief unfulfilled, he insisted that his injured leg be amputated below the knee, convinced that he could still be effective as a salvage diver once he trained himself to run, swim, and dive with the proper prosthetic. At the scene depicting his official hearing to determine his readiness to return to duty after surgery and rehab, Brashear's character, played by Cuba Gooding Jr., responds to a question from the presiding officer, a skeptical Navy captain who doubts Brashear's fitness for the physically demanding job of a Navy salvage diver. "You're almost 40 and you have one good leg," the officer starts. "Do you really think you can keep up with healthy divers half your age?" Brashear's answer, whether the invention of a Hollywood scriptwriter or an actual statement at the time, comes right out of the Deion Sanders playbook. "The question is, sir, can they keep up with me?" First victory takeaway. The pressure's always on the other guy. Just play your game the way you know how. 5. They have to believe in themselves, and that's what I do. I help the secondary believe in themselves. I have to be careful here. While Sanders exemplifies the self-confident athlete, I don't know what kind of teammate he was. While doing the research for this book, I was unable to find comments from his former teammates complimenting him for his positive influence in the locker room or the meeting room. On the contrary, there are plenty of comments about how Sanders was far more concerned about his own stats and accolades than he was about the success of the teams he played on. So what are we to make of his statement, "I help the secondary believe in themselves"? I think the first victory takeaway here is this. Projecting an aura of genuine confidence, which Sanders most certainly did, and modeling optimism and mental resiliency whenever the breaks go against him or his team, which he also did, are both valuable contributions to any team or work group. We're all on one team or another, and in some cases several. Even the individual sport athlete, golfer, tennis player, has a coach/mentor, and most likely a partner or spouse. So does the individual artist and sole proprietor of every small business. Every musician, even those who perform solo, relies on a team of light, sound, and recording pros to make performances happen. Every surgeon works with a team that includes an anesthesiologist and several nurses. These teammates who are working with you and supporting you should get the benefit of your belief in yourself. They don't deserve to be the ones who see you at your worst or whom you complain to in your low moments. Save all that for your sport or performance psychologist. What do your teammates get from you? Would they say that you maintain a great attitude regardless of whether you or the team are riding a hot streak or struggling through a downturn? There's a very trite saying on this, but it is absolutely true, as anyone who's ever been a part of a team will agree. Attitudes are contagious. Is yours worth catching? Although I cannot say for certain, I'm pretty sure that Sanders' teammates in the defensive secondary fed off his confidence and played better because of it. First victory takeaway? Project an aura of genuine confidence, modeling optimism and mental resilience. The big first victory takeaway. Deciding to be different. Thanks for getting me back on track, Doc Z. The speaker was Danny Briere, a 17-year veteran of the National Hockey League, whose enduring legacy was his ability to play his best hockey at the biggest moments in the biggest games. At 5'8" and 170 pounds, Briere relied on speed, guile, and, yes, confidence to score 116 points in 124 Stanley Cup playoff games. Briere had been exposed to sports psychology early in his pro career as a member of the Phoenix Coyotes, and the confident mentality he developed helped him become a top-tier NHL player and captain of the Buffalo Sabres from 2005 to 2007. But when he signed with the Philadelphia Flyers in 2007, things changed. It was a new team in a new city with a new coach and a very big contract. And all those adjustments turned into distractions that brought Danny Briere's confidence down. Instead of taking the ice with the attitude that he was twice the size of any other player, Briere began to doubt himself, and those doubts affected his performance and production. But those doubts didn't last very long. Danny Briere and I went to work on his attitude, and rebuilt his mental bank account with a steady diet of quality envisioning, constructive self-talk, e.g., I deliver when the game's on the line, and by adopting Deion Sanders' idea that the ball was meant to come to me. In the final game of the 2010 regular season, which the Flyers had to win to make the playoffs, Danny Briere's confidence, the result of this unconventional but constructive thinking, came through. That game ended in a tie and proceeded to a shootout, where each team selects three players to take an unopposed penalty shot against the other team's goalie. The teams alternate shooters, and the highest-scoring team wins the game. Danny Briere was the first shooter up for the Flyers, and as he prepared to charge down the ice and take on Henrik Lundqvist of the New York Rangers, the best goalie in the game, the magnitude of the moment crept up on him. I knew this was a pretty big deal. I knew everyone was watching me, that our playoffs hopes were on the line, that there was a lot riding on what I was about to do. And then he changed his mind. This is where I'm supposed to be. I was meant to be the difference maker. This moment was meant for me. Briere took the puck, flashed it past Lundqvist, and the Flyers won. Briere went on to have one of the greatest postseason performances in hockey history, recording 12 goals and 18 assists as the Flyers advanced to the 2010 Stanley Cup Finals. Reflecting on that performance, Danny Briere told me, "I can't thank you enough. Our work really made a difference, and it's weird that so few players think this way." Briere is dead on. Cultivating this inner sense of certainty and bringing it out when the game is on the line works. It's not a 100% guarantee of success at every turn, but it always gives you your best chance. So why do relatively few players and relatively few people fully embrace it and use it consistently? Simple but challenging answer. Because it goes against what is taught in schools and by society in general about how one should behave and how one should pursue success. Most people were brought up to share society's general distaste of outspoken and confident people like Muhammad Ali, and were taught to think of them as too arrogant, too conceited, too full of themselves. Did you have a teacher in middle school, high school, or college who encouraged you to think that you were the best at what you do? That no matter what just happened, you were going to succeed at your next opportunity, and that every uncertain situation was likely to come out in your favor as long as you put in the work? If you did, consider yourself very lucky. Most people weren't so lucky. Most of us were socialized by well-meaning teachers, coaches, and other authority figures who encouraged us to find our place in the world and comfortably fit in rather than build the self-confidence that would help us stand out. Ask yourself these questions. What were the key sources of your thinking habits, emotional tendencies, and beliefs about yourself? How did you learn to think the way you do? Were the people and institutions who taught you and guided you during your formative years interested in helping you discover how, dare I say, awesome you could be? Or were they more interested in making sure that you fit comfortably into the world of normalcy and didn't rock the boat too much? What were you encouraged, in both explicit ways and in more subtle and implicit ways, to pursue? The full expression of your unique talents? Or the safety and security that modern life, with all its technologies and conveniences, can provide? What were you taught about how to think in order to pursue success and satisfaction? I'd like to challenge you a little here and ask you to look carefully at some beliefs that clients and students of mine have brought into my office over the last 30 years. Beliefs that they have acquired through socialization during their school years, early playing days, and formative training. I will describe how they encourage the kind of thinking that brings your mental bank account down instead of building it up. While no single one of these beliefs will break your confidence, their combined influence, reinforced over a period of years and often communicated by figures of authority, can prevent you from developing the effective thinking habits described in the previous chapters. Refusing to buy into these beliefs, resisting these articles of socialization privately within the confines of your own mind, will help you win one first victory after another. Limiting belief number one. Remember your failures and mistakes. Those memories motivate you to improve. This belief puts a constant negative pull on your mental bank account, dropping the wrong memories into your running total of thoughts and effectively running your bank account down. You might feel a momentary surge of energy produced by the anger aroused by the memory of a past mistake, but that energy surge is short-lived and leaves a nasty residue that you have to work through to improve. There's a cleaner burning and longer-lasting fuel source you can use. The memories of effort, success, and progress, and the vision of the future you really want. Limiting belief number two. Always be your own harshest critic. There are certainly times when you have to look yourself squarely in the eye and acknowledge your mistakes and shortcomings. But there are also times when you should do the opposite. Sadly, however, the myth persists that if a certain amount of seriousness and self-criticism is good for you, then a lot of it must be better. As a result, a steady stream of self-criticism can become your default setting, with you believing that you are actually helping yourself by maintaining it. In reality, though, you're just buying into mediocrity by beating yourself up and drawing your mental bank account down. Face it, if you criticize yourself all the time in practice and think about all the things you have to improve when you're away from practice, then you shouldn't be surprised when you don't feel any confidence on game day. Save the self-judgment and the self-criticism for the right moments when you are away from the action, the times when you can calmly and rationally acknowledge your weaknesses without condemning or belittling yourself. Limiting belief number three. Always be logical and think carefully about what you're doing. School was basically an exercise in logical reasoning. The hours we spent learning the multiplication tables and the rules of grammar drilled into us the idea that everything could be broken down into its components and then logically reassembled. Maybe music and art class might have given us an opportunity to be spontaneous and creative, but often even these activities were taught as a set of rules and logical structures to follow. When it comes to confidence, however, logic isn't always helpful. Logic dictates that the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior, that the team or opponent that beat you last time will do it again, that the job task that has always been troublesome will continue to be so. If strict logic was indeed the answer to everything and had always been followed, the Wright brothers would have never gotten off the ground, and Roger Bannister would never have broken 4 minutes in the mile run. Being logical closes us off from creativity, joy, and the discovery of anything new, precisely those things that give our lives the greatest meaning. Limiting belief number four. Always look for more knowledge, more information, more practice opportunities. Constantly looking for the latest and greatest technical tips and inside information pointers sure sounds like a great way to improve yourself, but there are a few downsides to it that aren't well understood. First, the belief that there is some solution out there to be discovered encourages you to look outside of yourself rather than look inward into the nature of your thinking habits. Is the limiting factor in your professional or performance life really a lack of knowledge, not knowing what to do or how to do it? Or is it a lack of trust in yourself to do all the things you already know how to do? Maybe the best way to take your sport, passion, or profession to the next level is by looking inside instead. Second, This belief encourages you to become more preoccupied with mechanics and technical instruction. And as we've discussed throughout this book, too much of that can lead to overthinking and confusion. Taken a couple steps further, this belief can trap you into destructive perfectionism, where you feel you're never enough no matter how much you know or how hard you've worked. The truth is that the fewer things you have in your mind when you perform, the more efficiently your brain and nervous system will operate. Limiting belief number 5. You better be really good at something before you become confident about it. This belief plays a nasty trick on you. It prevents you from feeling certain about yourself by always kicking your confidence down the road, always putting it just beyond your reach. It makes you ask yourself dangerous questions such as, am I good enough at blank? Have I done enough? What else could I have done to train/improve/prepare? These questions open the door just wide enough for self-doubt to come crashing through. They prevent you from believing in yourself now, and you may not have the luxury of more time and the necessary training resources that your self-doubt keeps insisting you need. Besides the fact that you may need to believe in yourself now, the forever questioning brought on by this belief almost guarantees that you will never feel truly confident. It will always elude you because there is always more that you could have done. An important fact to realize here is that your state of mind, your sense of certainty, is a choice that you make regardless of the situation you are in and regardless of the level of preparation you have achieved. Limiting belief number 6. Worship the gods. The experts know what's best and the winners have earned your reverence. I don't remember where I first heard it, but I've always gotten a kick out of the saying, if you have a hero, the best you can ever be is second place. We read of Washington, Lincoln, and other iconic figures throughout our childhood, while social media and mass media advertising bombarded us with a constant stream of images and messages designed to make us yearn to be like some movie star, billionaire, or sports hero. Perhaps some people are inspired to follow these examples, but many more people end up questioning themselves and doubting that they'll ever live up to such standards. Unfortunately, the images of these godlike heroes put out by print, broadcast, and now social media are generally false. They are created not to tell the truth about anyone, but to sustain the media outlets through the sale of advertising. Why buy into the image of an opponent or a competitor as it's portrayed in a magazine or TV spot? Looking up to some icon on a pedestal teaches us to compare our records and accomplishments with those of our competitors and opponents. Result? We end up overestimating our competition and underestimating ourselves when we don't really need to. Limiting belief number 7. Above all else, thou shalt not screw up, a.k.a. the team that makes the fewest mistakes wins. I have found that nothing erodes and destroys confidence more than the fear of making mistakes in performance. In a truly ironic way, we are all socialized to fear making mistakes so much that we tie ourselves up in knots trying to avoid them and end up doing worse. When the fear of making a mistake is in your mind, you become cautious instead of assertive, reserved instead of intense, overly analytic instead of natural and flowing. This belief implies that great players and performers almost never make errors. And if you buy into that, you are caught in another vicious mental trap. Once you make one or two errors as you perform, then you're automatically out of it. Your shot at greatness is over. Since those mistakes are inevitable, human imperfection being what it is, believing that the team that makes the fewest mistakes wins puts you in a steady state of tension and worry. Each of the preceding confidence-undermining elements of socialization can be resisted. These limiting beliefs only have power if you choose to endorse them. You can choose some alternative beliefs about the pursuit of success and satisfaction that may be different from those that you grew up with, but will help you develop the sense of certainty that always gives you the best chance of success. You can choose to think differently than most people, and when you do so, you give yourself a chance to perform differently than most people. In that spirit, here are 7 alternatives to the limiting beliefs described previously. Beliefs to adopt and embrace to help you develop your own Deion Sanders, Danny Briere level of confidence. Think of them as expanded contribution limits to your mental bank account and special interest rates that allow your account to grow at the maximum rate possible. First victory alternative number 1. Remember what you want more of, that alters your brain and body so you'll get more of it. Be honest with yourself. What creates more eagerness and motivation to move forward, mentally replaying that narrow loss you suffered and feeling it sting, or mentally replaying one of your most successful moments? A cadet on the West Point wrestling team replied this way, "When I remember my losses, I feel this huge sensation of fatigue, but when I remember my wins, I feel this lightness and energy. It's interesting because I know I was just as physically drained after the wins as I was after the losses, but those memories feel entirely different." This statement is supported by the latest science. A significant body of research has demonstrated that recalling autobiographical memories that have a positive content, or in plainer language, simply remembering the good times, reduces the activity of the brain circuits that create the sensation of stress, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. Other studies indicate that recalling positive memories make you less susceptible to depression. Neither stress nor depression will help you learn new skills, improve your present skills, or perform under pressure. On the other hand, joy and excitement, the opposites of stress and depression, have been shown to facilitate learning and performance. So as the old rock and roll song goes, let the good times roll. Cultivate the habit of dropping into your brain ideas about and images of what you want more of. First victory alternative belief number 2. Always be your own best and most honest friend. You always stick up for your best friend, right? You accept his, her imperfections and weaknesses and still bring the love. You encourage and support him, her, no matter what. Even if that person really messes up something, you stay on their side. During the times where something goes really badly, you're likely to take your best friend aside and say something like, "Look, I know you didn't mean to, but you really messed that up, and you're going to have to fix it. It might be tough, but I know you can do it. Let me know how I can help." Usually after a talk like this, your best friend heaves a sigh and gets to work, knowing that you're still in their corner. They are really glad to have a friend like you. But do you treat yourself that same way? Do you give yourself that same degree of support, that same level of what is called in psychology talk, unconditional positive regard? I've found that very few people do. They have plenty of compassion for their best friends, especially when those friends are suffering. But they have little compassion for themselves in their own moments of pain and difficulty. Why? Because they've accepted the lie that accepting their own imperfections, that turning their compassion inward will make them complacent, lazy, and lead to poor performances. If you've accepted this lie in your life, take a tip from Helen Maroulis, who became the first American woman to win gold in Olympic wrestling at the 2016 Rio Olympic Games. And she did it by defeating Japan's Saori Yoshida, the most successful female wrestler in history, who hadn't lost a match in international competition in the previous 16 years. With 4 weeks to go before the Olympic trials in 2016, Marula still had 15 pounds to lose in order to make her required 53-kilogram weight, and the USA training team was concerned. While still training hard and dieting relentlessly, Marulis found ways to be her own best friend and take some pressure off herself by spending time with her boyfriend, taking a few trips to the beach, and conducting youth wrestling clinics during these critical weeks. As she explained in her History Channel documentary, "You have to step back and be relaxed and balanced. It's always about scaling things back and getting perspective. Whether I do or don't get it, the spot on the Olympic team, it doesn't affect who I am." Then, at the 2016 Olympic trials, Marulis truly became her own best friend by finally forgiving herself for not making the previous Olympic team in 2012. "And that was the last thing that had to get hashed out before I could just go out there and compete." And compete she did, defeating five opponents by a combined score of 64-2, and setting herself up for success at the Games. When I interviewed Helen in 2018 before an audience of West Point cadet athletes and their coaches, she further emphasized the importance of being your own best friend and accepting your weaknesses just as you would those of your friends. "I went back to my journal 5 days right before the Olympics, and I realized, wow, I'm looking for perfection, and I'm never going to find it. It's not a bad thing to look for perfection, but what's bad is the attitude that I had, meaning that I was never pleased with what I had. I asked myself, what am I going to do with perfection? What do I really want out of perfection? What I want out of perfection is excellence. Can I still have excellence without finding perfection? Yes. All I needed to do was be enough to outscore my opponent, to be enough to win that match. And I say this all the time, I won with all of my strengths and I won with all of my weaknesses." And I think sometimes we maybe lose sight of that, that we can't win or we can't achieve things with those weaknesses, but you're always going to achieve things with those weaknesses. Acceptance, forgiveness, compassion. These valuable methods of supporting your best friend's pursuit of excellence work for your own pursuit as well. Use them. First victory alternative belief number 3. Use both logic and creative fantasy to create your own reality. Just as there is a time and place for self-criticism, there is a time and place for careful, logical analysis. There is also a time and place, as discussed previously, for self-compassion, and most definitively, a time and a place to throw realism and logic out the window and trust whatever skills and abilities you have. I urge my clients to limit their careful, logical thinking to only those practice drills and practice activities that involve a single skill, like simple passing and catching in basketball, or simple pads low, come off the ball fast drills in football. The rest of the practice, when performing complex drills involving many skills simultaneously, I urge them to turn off their careful analytical minds and look and do, sense and react. Why? Because the mental process of conscious analysis interferes with the smooth execution of skilled movements, sports, performing arts, surgery, and the automatic retrieval of remembered information, testing, taking questions from an audience, making a counterargument. The human mind's conscious analytic capacity is indeed wonderful and valuable, but just as wonderful and equally valuable is the mind's unconscious competence. Sadly, most people only develop their logical minds, missing out on the possibilities that they might have experienced had they only allowed themselves to be a little more playful, a little more creative, a little less realistic. Most people will never attempt anything unless their logical analysis of the situation tells them that they have at least a 50-50 chance of succeeding. Donna McAleer, West Point class of 1987, is not one of those most people. She left her corporate job and spent 2 years training full-time to make the Olympic bobsled team, despite never having been a power athlete. She twice ran for the U.S. Congress as a Democrat in Utah, a state that ranks 43rd in the number of women in elected offices. She knew that neither of these goals were realistic, but she pursued them with conviction and energy, firmly believing that if she worked both hard and smart, she'd come out on top in the end. Skeptics will say that since she didn't make the Olympic team or win the election to Congress, she was just wasting her time. But Donna McAleer doesn't see it that way. In her mind, being a Catholic, Democratic congresswoman from the overwhelmingly Mormon state of Utah made perfect sense and was exactly what the world needed. That was the reality she chose to create and believe in. The alternative reality, the logical reality, that the incumbent male Republican candidate was a lock for re-election, was just a justification for negativity. In her notable 2010 book, Porcelain on Steel, Women of West Point's Long Gray Line, Donna McAleer profiled 14 women who graduated from West Point and went on to remarkable careers, generals in the Army, Olympic team members, business leaders, etc. Each one of them refused to buy into the status quo and created for themselves a life of their own choosing. Their stories, and Donna McAleer's own story, remind me of what Tiger Woods told Oprah Winfrey after winning his first Masters Golf Championship at the age of 21, the youngest ever to do so. "The thing I've always believed is that you should never place limits on yourself. Once you do that, then that's what you're confined to. Be creative. Go beyond expectations, not just of yourself, but expectations of a human being. Go beyond that. Be creative. That's one of the things I've done. That's one of the reasons I've excelled, because I know no boundaries inside." Great accomplishments, like winning the Masters at age 21, writing a groundbreaking book, and sustaining oneself through a grueling congressional election campaign, always begin with someone refusing to accept the boundaries and the limiting logic of, do I have at least a 50-50 chance of success? Use realism and logic when making the small, hour-by-hour decisions, but use some creative fantasy, however unrealistic it might be, when thinking about your long-term horizons. First victory alternative belief number 4. The key is enough knowledge consistently applied. Do more and do it all better seems to be the operating philosophy when it comes both to personal and team improvement. It's certainly not a bad idea, but it does have its downside, as discussed previously. A particular experience I had as a graduate student impressed upon me an alternative. Learn enough and be skilled enough in a couple key areas and then apply those skills consistently. That experience was working for my University of Virginia professors on a study of the determinants of success on the PGA Tour. My job was to manually enter data from the PGA, every stat on every player for a full season, into the university's mainframe computer. This was the late 80s, well before today's level of technology. We then asked the computer to analyze the data and determine which stat, average length of drive, number of strokes to reach the green, etc., was the best predictor of earnings. Which golf stat has the strongest influence on the prize money a player earns? The computer concluded that out of all the available data, the factor that separated the highest earners from lowest earners was only the number of putts a player consistently made per round. The high earners made between one and two fewer putts per round every round. They simply did one thing routinely better than the rest. Every player on the tour drove the ball well, and every player got onto the green. But the few who putted well consistently came home with the big bucks. I think there's a valuable lesson there. What one or two key points would make the difference in your work if they were consistently addressed? Have these become the focus of your attention every day to the point where you can trust them unconditionally? Or are you constantly seeking out new knowledge to expand your toolkit? In his book, Good to Great, Jim Collins refers to these trusted core competencies as your hedgehog, a reference to the old fable in which the sleek and agile fox tries one trick after another to trap the slow and ponderous hedgehog, only to be thwarted each time by the hedgehog's one and only defense, curling up with his bristles extending outward. The hedgehog can always trust his bristles, just as the best PGA golfers can trust their putting skills. What can you trust? Special Forces Captain Tom Hendricks decided to trust his understanding of battlefield dynamics during his final deployment to Iraq in 2014, where he advised and trained Iraq's own Special Forces soldiers. He had been directing a raid by his Iraqi soldiers on an ISIS-held oil refinery for 3 hours when the radio connecting him to the soldiers on the ground went dead. Their own commander was dead. The entire troop was pinned down, taking heavy fire from an overwhelming enemy force. "And my direct line of communication goes out," Hendricks recalled. He stayed in the fight, however, and continued to call in the airstrikes that saved the remaining Iraqi soldiers and secured the refinery by watching the video feed from a drone aircraft flying overhead and instantly translating the drone's aerial images into the precise locations where steel on target was needed. "I couldn't hear them, and they couldn't hear me, but I could envision the battle space, and I knew the plan, so I had to be confident in it." Later, Tom Hendricks was gratefully embraced by the father of one of the surviving Iraqi soldiers. "My only living son survived, thanks to you," exclaimed the man, who had already lost 2 sons in the war against ISIS. "But I didn't do anything heroic," Hendricks observed. "I just used my skills and was confident in them." If you don't believe in yourself, why should anyone else? At some point, you decide that you have enough. Find your core, find your hedgehog, and put it to work consistently. Maybe you won't be saving lives under fire in Iraq or winning large purses on the PGA Tour, but whatever you do, you'll be in a position to succeed at it. First Victory Alternative Belief Number 5. Beliefs produce behavior, so confidence comes first. The conversation about which comes first, competence or confidence, has dragged on for years, decades, and even centuries. Sun Tzu's concept of a first victory dates back to the 5th century BC, so people were talking about it even then. I'm taking the position that the initial spark of confidence, that first victory, has to come first. I have 2 reasons for taking this position. First, without that initial spark of confidence, there won't be sufficient energy, drive, motivation, and awareness to develop any competence. We're not necessarily talking about Deion Sanders-level confidence here. Just that inkling of possibility. Just enough certainty to try something. As mentioned earlier, you might remember that time in your life when you did not have the competence to ride a 2-wheeled bicycle. But somehow you had the idea that you could do it just the same. Something inside you told you that you could develop this very desirable competence, and despite the frustrating falls and scraped knees, evidence that you weren't competent, you maintained enough certainty in your eventual success to motivate you to try it again until you got it. The confidence was there. You just had to feed it with a succession of improvements, a little more distance successfully ridden each time, and that effective thinking enabled your eventual success. Second, I have witnessed perfectly competent individuals equipped with all the requisite skills paralyze themselves into mediocrity and inaction because they refuse to allow themselves to be confident. These individuals are very good at telling themselves an interesting story, that whatever competence they might have is somehow less than what is required. They convince themselves that their resume of success as a high school champion isn't enough to justify some confidence at the college level, or that the professional resume that earned them their present position isn't enough for them to feel confident that they can get that next promotion. They are nearly always wrong. The truth is that you never know just how competent you are until you act with full confidence. Win the first victory, and all the other ones have a chance to follow. First Victory Alternative Belief Number 6. Know thyself and trust thyself, for every competitor is human and beatable. Time to resist the hype, publicity, rumor, and gossip about opponents and competitors. Our media-saturated world provides far too much unhelpful information. And without the proper resistance, you might become predisposed to uncritically accept some of that written and broadcast hype as gospel. It's one thing to respect, study, and even learn from an opponent or competitor. That makes great sense. But it's vital to maintain a certain first victory perspective as you do so. Coaches and managers sometimes unknowingly miss this when presenting the scouting report on this week's opponent to their team or identifying competitors in the marketplace. They highlight the stats, strengths, and accomplishments of that opponent without devoting equal time to describing the weaknesses and vulnerabilities. Here's my recommendation, an alternative way to look at any opponent, competitor, or rival you might have to face, no matter how impressive their hype might be. Use your imagination a little and think about what that person might look like as they shuffle into their bathroom at 6 a.m., eyes still half closed, hair all tousled, yawning and grumbling. What do they look like as they fumble to find their toothbrush or clumsily wash their face? Is anyone impressive when they do that? If you think about what any person looks like as he or she completes the full list of typical morning bathroom behaviors, you'll see them in their most human, most vulnerable, and most beatable condition. This simple reality check illustrates a key point. Even the most hyped-up star is a person just like you. And just like you, they come with their complete share of fears, doubts, and imperfections. It took Kelly Calway, an elite distance runner who has qualified for the Olympic marathon trials 3 times, a while to learn this. She wasn't the top recruit for the distance running group of the North Carolina State University track team, and she let herself get a little too impressed with the blue chippers. It wasn't until she won the Duke Invitational Mile and beat them in her senior year that she realized just how much she had held herself back. As she was training for the 2012 Olympic marathon trials and working on her attitude with me, she learned to view the top-ranked female runners as no different from her. They had hopes and dreams just like her. They loved to race and win just like her. They had fears, doubts, and episodes of injury just like her. This work, in Calway's own words, was life-changing. Instead of lining up at the start of a race and thinking, "Who am I to be right here next to a returning national champion?" she learned to come to the line narrowly focused on her race plan and maintain a steady stream of motivational self-talk throughout her races. Now a U.S. Army major working in the military intelligence branch, Calway also coaches the All-Army Marathon team while raising 2 daughters. And when she races, she respects herself as much as she does any competitor. So forget the experts who create the rankings and the hype. Buying into those images and those stories does nothing for your confidence. Every opponent is human and beatable. Every situation is understandable and winnable. First Victory Alternative Belief Number 7. Above all else, play to win. On February 5th, 2012, New York Giant quarterback Eli Manning took the snap from the center on his own 11-yard line with 3 minutes and 46 seconds remaining in Super Bowl 46. The favored New England Patriots were leading the Giants 17-15, and if the Giants didn't score on this drive, that would likely be the final outcome. Manning first looked to the right side of the field and instantly recognized that his receivers were tightly covered. He looked back to his left, then stepped up, and threw a high, arcing pass that covered 43 yards in the air and dropped perfectly into the hands of receiver Mario Manningham. Two Patriot defenders were right on top of Manningham, but the ball was so accurately placed that either Manningham would make the catch or it would fall incomplete out of bounds. That completion, widely regarded as the play of the game, set up the Giants' winning touchdown and earned Eli Manning his second Super Bowl MVP trophy. 2 days later, on February 7th, Manning took the following question from ESPN radio host Michael Kay on Kay's nationally syndicated radio broadcast. "Do you ever consider the ramifications of failure at a time like that?" referring to Manning's decision to make that throw at that moment. Manning's response was simple and to the point. "That's exactly what you don't do." After a second's pause, Manning continued, "You recall all the times you succeeded in those moments. You recall the game earlier versus the Patriots where you had a fourth quarter drive to win. You recall the game versus Dallas where you had a fourth quarter drive to win. Miami, Buffalo. You recall all the successes. And you forget about the games where you didn't have the drives, where you fell short on those opportunities. You have to misremember those moments and just recall the positive ones. That's the feeling." That's the statement of a performer who has won the first victory. Rather than operate from the belief that the team or player that makes the fewest mistakes wins, so I better not make a mistake here, Manning operated from the belief that the team or player who plays well despite making mistakes wins. The former belief leads you to worry about both the mistakes you've made and those you might make. That worry leads to tension in the muscles, which in turn degrades your performance, the classic sewer cycle. The latter belief leads to thoughts about playing well now, executing the way you've trained and practiced, bringing what you have to the moment at hand. Those thoughts produce Eli Manning's feeling, which in turn excites the body while not overtensing it, so that a great play has the best chance of emerging. The belief above all else, play to win, and the other alternative beliefs discussed previously, are indeed different from what your socialization may have taught you. But let's remember that the purpose of socialization is to encourage conformity and the continued existence of the prevailing social order. Its purpose is not to help you discover the full extent of your talents and abilities. If you're a little hung up on thinking differently from the crowd, the very thing that socialization exists to support, you're likely to remain in the crowd. You'll be normal. But is that really what you want? When my clients admit that they feel a little uncomfortable taking on these new beliefs, that it seems a little weird and strange to be searching for their own version of Eli Manning-level confidence, I always remind them that the difference between special and wonderful and weird and strange is entirely in their own minds, that it's a choice they are making about themselves each and every minute. What choice are you making now? To go with the crowd or to think in ways that help you be ever more special and wonderful? Your first victory depends on this choice.